Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
We went months without any sports at all. We were relegated to betting on the weather. It was that bad. Then suddenly, it was as if everything all came back at once. And then there was a stretch where it seemed like every single night there was some combination of the NBA playoffs, NHL playoffs, MLB postseason, NFL football. Like all of a sudden we went from nothing to everything, and every night we had something. Until last night. Because without a Game 7 of the World Series, there was nothing. Suddenly, we went from being overloaded with must-win games to no games at all. In fact, yesterday afternoon, I even texted the flight deck, James Kelly, saying, "The hell are we supposed to do tonight? There is nothing to bet on. Where do we go for our entertainment this evening, big head? There are no games." So, in the weirdest year ever, last night was definitely one of the weirder nights. But fear not, the sun did come up. And football is back tonight. And not just any football, but Atlanta Falcons football. A brand of football onto its own, because nobody can do it like these guys. And if anybody belongs in prime time, on the big stage, under the bright lights, it is the Falcons. The NFL's most legendary train wreck. I mean, you never know exactly what you're going to get with these guys. Only that it's going to be awesome. Well, awesome for us. Horrific for them, because if there is a way to come from way ahead and choke, they will find it. They will do it. They have proven it time and time again, and they've got a great opportunity to do so this evening in Carolina. Matt Ryan v. Teddy Bridgewater, Robbie Anderson v. the Falcons secondary, both teams versus the weather. I know what you're thinking. You're looking to clap back on me like, "Hey, Rome, a Thursday night game with a one-win team. What are you so fired up about, V-Smac? Are you a gambling degenerate? Why are you trying to convince us that we should be too?" And look, it seems to me pretty self-evident, but if you still need help, I am here to give it to you. Here's why. Tonight's game is not about the Falcons versus the Panthers. It's about the Falcons versus themselves. The Falcons versus history. The Falcons versus the laws of science. Yes, I'm fired up about these guys. The Falcons are an amazing team. Like, if you look at their record, you see a 1-6 team. But when I look at that team, I see one of the most compelling, mesmerizing crews ever. Take a look at the teams with the worst record in the NFL. Cincinnati, they've got one win, but they've got a hell of a quarterback. If you were to tell me the Bengals were 4-3 instead of 1-5-1, I would believe you. Houston, a mess. Minnesota, who the hell knows? The Jags, pretty forgettable. The Giants, garbage.
Garbage.
The Jets, hot garbage.
Garbage.
Which brings us back to the Falcons. Atlanta.
Atlanta.
Four of their losses have been by one score. So they could easily be 5-2 instead of 1-6. In fact, it would be easier to be 5-2 than 1-6 because two of their losses have been by 1 point. And a number of them have been flat out impossible. Like, go back to week 2. Remember Atlanta at Dallas?
Atlanta.
Mike McCarthy's home debut. The Cowboys were, I know, shocking, a complete and total disaster. They fumbled 3 times in the first half. The Falcons were up 15 with 5 minutes to go. That game was over. But then all hell broke loose. The Falcons gave up a touchdown to make it 39-30. They get the ball back. They gain 12 yards. Then they punt. They give up another touchdown. Now it's 39-37. Then they went legend, try to recover that onside kick, remember? By going legend, I mean they stood there, they did nothing, and they allowed Dallas to jump on the ball.
So it's a 2-point game with 1:49 to go.
Got to be careful, this little dribbler down the middle now.
Yeah. And the ball is recovered by Dallas. The ball spun around, Atlanta looked at it.
Atlanta.
It rolled across, and Dallas got it.
Rolling on the field is a recovery by Dallas. First down.
How in the world, Dave?
Well, he didn't kick it far enough, so Atlanta backed away from the ball.
And now, all of a sudden, the Cowboys have a chance.
Falcons radio. Never mind, Dave. I'll handle that for you. You guys stood around with their thumbs up their backsides, doing nothing. That's what happened. Sure enough, Dallas kicks a field goal, and time expires, and they win 40-39. And everybody rushed to Atlanta head coach Dan Quinn to ask him what the hell happened.
Atlanta! Just got done with the team in the locker room, and it's tough to put a loss like that in place. I told the team there has to be a lesson in the pain of that loss, and I'm sure we will work into that next week, but definitely one that stings.
Yeah, I'm sure that did. Hey, listen, clones, the reason I'm spending so much time on this is you're thinking to yourselves, great, another crappy Thursday night game with a one-win team. What am I going to do? I'm helping you. I'm here to help you. I'm here to give you perspective. I'm here to set this thing up for you. You're going to watch that game, and you're going to like that game because Atlanta is involved. 1 week later, against the Bears, Atlanta's up 16. Less than 7 minutes to go. They had chased Mitchell Trubisky. Nick Foles came in, and he threw not one, not two, but three touchdowns in the final 6.5 minutes for yet another iconic loss for the Falcons. Afterwards, Quinn said, quote, "These last 2 weeks have been nothing short of crushing," end quote. I'll tell you how crushing. In so doing, Atlanta became the first team in NFL history to lose back-to-back games where they had 15-point leads in the fourth quarter. Did you know that? I don't want to gloss over that either. The NFL has been played a long, long time. The Shield has been around for a long, long time. There have been a lot of games played. There have been a lot of really bad teams that have played a lot of games. But not one team other than the Falcons had ever pulled that off. Because you can't just be bad to blow back-to-back 15-point leads in the fourth quarter. You have to be good enough to get up by 15. And then bad enough to choke. That is a nearly impossible combo to pull off. Again, you have to be good enough to be beating the hell out of a team for three quarters. But then be bad enough to choke it away and completely shut down in the final quarter. And these are the guys that can do that. In fact, they have done that. Hell, they do it all the time. So, what makes them so special? Why is Atlanta Atlanta? Why are they the only franchise that can pull this off?
Atlanta.
Because they have weapons. Because they have an offense that has the likes of Matt Ryan, Julio Jones, Calvin Ridley. You have to have an offense gifted enough to create explosive plays. Then you have to have a defense gifted enough to give up explosive plays. And the Falcons are that. They lead the league in explosive plays given up per game and yards per pass play given up per game. You see where I'm going with this. This is a very unique crew. After the Bears' loss, defensive end Dante Fowler Jr. said, quote, "It doesn't get no worse than this. We probably found the two worst ways we could lose a football game." My man, good use of that double negative. It don't get no worse than this. Nothing but respect, D. Because I'm sure it felt that way at that time. I'm sure you were thinking there is no possible way to lose a game that would be worse than not jumping on an onside kick and by having the Bears offense light you up. Except it did get worse. It always does with the Falcons. I hate to break it to you, but you and the fellas did find a way to lose that's worse. Which I'll get to in a minute, but the Falcons chased the Bears' loss with a couple of more traditional ones. They got cracked at Lambeau by the Packers. Then they got handled by the Panthers at home. And then after the Carolina loss, Dan Quinn and Thomas Dimitroff were fired. And then something amazing happened. The Falcons went to Minnesota and they won. And they didn't just win, they destroyed the Vikings. They were up 23-0 and then 40-15 in the fourth. Such an enormous lead, even they couldn't choke it away. And what's that say about the Vikings, by the way? Anyway, you see a game like that and you think, maybe these guys have flipped the switch. Maybe they've turned it around. Maybe this thing's going to get right. Remember when Dante said the Falcons probably found the two worst ways you can lose a football game? Yeah, well, he was wrong. Because fast forward to last Sunday, they managed to lose a game by winning. Todd Gurley took a lot of heat when he accidentally scored with 64 seconds left. Remember?
So on first and goal now from the 10, the give is to Gurley. Gurley through the middle. They're going to let him score. And he went in. Gurley did score.
He broke the play.
He went across for the touchdown. The Lions gave it to him with 1:04 to go. And that's a big mistake by Todd Gurley. the Lions are going to get it back, at worst, down 6 points. Wow, what a mental mistake by Todd Gurley has kept the Lions alive in this one.
Lions
he
radio.
Tried to stop himself, but he broke the plane. He realized at the one-yard line, I don't want to score, and he tried to dive to his right, but as he did, he broke the plane. That is a huge mistake.
Do you know my favorite part of that? Were Lions defenders holding up the touchdown sign. When have you ever seen that? When have you ever seen the defense allow a touchdown and then be like, touchdown! And they're holding up their arms to signify it, like they were so thrilled that he scored. That's my favorite part of that. I mean, that was so bad. And it gets even worse when you hear the NFL Films version of it and you hear Matt Ryan telling the team in the huddle, do not score. Do not score. He literally told Gurley, do not score.
Hey, don't score.
Yeah, I would
don't score.
Down.
Don't score. Get the first. Get the first. Get down.
The give is to Gurley. Gurley through the middle. They're going to let him score. And he went in. That's a big mistake by Todd Gurley.
Yeah,
Lions are going to get it back. What a mental mistake by Todd Gurley.
I mean, Matt Ryan, you heard him on the tape. It's incredible. He said it multiple times before the play. Don't score. Don't score. Don't score. Get the first. Get down. Don't score. And Gurley's like, right, so you want me to burst through the line and score, right? Got it. I'm your man.
Don't score.
Yeah, I would.
Don't score. Don't score.
So Gurley scores anyway, and he was pissed at himself after the game. But again, that is the best part about this whole thing, right? That is the best part about this whole thing. The best part about the Falcons, it's never just one thing. It's an entire implosion because the Falcons didn't lose that game when he scored. They lost that game with the defense, let the Lions march down the field in 64 seconds without any timeouts. That's the truly amazing thing. I mean, the simplest thing that could have happened was Matt Ryan told the offense not to score, and then they didn't score, then they kicked the field goal, then they won the game. The most complicated thing happened when he either forgot the instructions from 2 seconds earlier, or he just lost his balance and fell down in the end zone. But the defense still had to choke on itself and give up that long touchdown drive when the opposition had no timeouts left. Which brings me to tonight's question and why I spent the entire open on this. Which Falcons are we going to see? What new way will we see them lose? Will we see the onside kick? Will we see them choke like they did to Nick Foles? Or do these magicians have a whole new trick up their sleeve? I can't wait. Do not let me down. I don't want some mail-it-in 10-point loss in bad weather. Make history tonight. Make me proud. And most of all, do not do anything stupid like, I don't know, win? I know you're trying to get this thing turned around. I know you've actually played a little harder for Raheem Morris than you did Quinn. I know this. I just don't like it. Stop doing it. And remember who you are. The Atlanta Fail Clowns.
Fail Clowns.
My job. I'm trying to get you ready for a Thursday night game. October is Fire Prevention Month, and we have teamed up with First Alert, the most trusted brand in fire safety, to help you get prepared for the unexpected and to review some key safety tips. As an example, smoke and carbon monoxide alarms help provide an early warning in the event of a home emergency. And having enough First Alert smoke and carbon monoxide alarms is one of the best things that you can do for both your home and your family. You want to install alarms on every single level and in every single bedroom of your home. Once those alarms are installed, it is important to maintain them by testing them with regularity. Also, remember this, alarms do not last forever. They do need to be replaced at least every 10 years. If you cannot remember the last time you replaced yours, it is best to replace the unit completely. As an option, my favorite is First Alert's combination smoke and carbon monoxide alarm with a 10-year sealed battery. That way the alarm provides 2-for-1 protection against smoke and carbon monoxide, and I don't have to worry about changing the batteries for a decade. For more information on fire safety products, safety tips, and educational activities that you can do at home with your family, just go to firstalert.com/fireprevention month, firstalert.com/fireprevention month. Bo Jackson is the most impressive athlete I have ever seen, period. Bo Jackson, the most impressive athlete I have ever seen in my lifetime. And it's not just that he played professional baseball and pro football and did so at the same time. There have been a few other guys who have done that. But they didn't come anywhere near, anywhere close to his holy crap moments in both sports that Bo produced. I'm talking about a guy who was an all-star in both sports. Not just a guy that played both sports at the same time, but a guy who was an all-star in both sports. A guy who not only could have been a Hall of Famer in one, I'd argue he could be a Hall of Famer in both. I mean, in either, but in both. Yeah, I said it. Like, if he doesn't get hurt and Bo wanted to spend his entire career playing both sports, he probably could have, and he probably could have ended up with two busts. The guy was that explosive. He was that much of a freak show. Like, if you're the right age, and I say Bo Jackson's name, you might think of that frozen rope that he threw to gun down Harold Reynolds at the plate. Or maybe that home run in the All-Star game. Or the home run he hit with one hand on the bat. Or that wall run. Or maybe you might go football and think about him humiliating Brian Bosworth and the Seahawks on Monday night. The guy was an unbelievable talent, a fierce running back, and his career ended way too soon. I mean, you want to talk about a two-sport star. This guy was so talented. Once when he came on this program, he did an interview and he ate a salad at the exact same time. Bo, it is great to have you back on. How are you?
Hey, Jim. I'm doing fine. I'm sitting, making phone calls, answering emails, and trying to eat a Caesar salad with grilled calamari at my favorite Italian restaurant.
It's a good life, Bo. It's a good life, and you've earned it. So where are you right now? What city?
Actually, I'm home in Chicago. And like I said, I've been out running errands and just working. Actually, I'm working harder now than I did when I did both sports.
All right, so the guy's doing an interview with me, and he's eating a calamari salad. Oh, and answering email, too. So again, let me say this very loudly and very proudly and very clearly. Bo Jackson is the most impressive athlete I've ever seen. Having said that, Bo was on the 21st and Prime podcast. Check out what Bo had to say about Bo.
Nobody to wrap up and tackle no more. With me being a ball carrier, my coach taught us number one. He said, I know you can run, but I'm going to teach you how to carry that football. He said, that football is like your newborn baby. Don't ever put it on the ground and keep it away from the enemy.
All right, so nothing too crazy there. A former player saying that guys today don't want to tackle, that they don't tackle the right way. I mean, nothing really crazy about that. Not really surprising. It's kind of what former players do, right? In pretty much every single sport, they say that it was way better back when they played. But then Bo takes it a step further.
It's like this, and I watch technique. I don't see nobody hitting, wrapping up. Everybody's running into each other and trying to use their shoulder pads, but not the ball carrier down.
All right, cool. Once again, I'm fine with this. Maybe wrapping up really is a lost art. Maybe guys are too focused on trying to hit guys with their shoulders and knock them down instead of actually tackling them. Maybe they're not focused on proper technique and fundamentals. I see you, Bo. Like, if you start to think about it and you watch Derrick Henry run and you watch what Derrick Henry's doing right now, you might start to imagine, man, if Derrick Henry could do that today, what would Bo Jackson be able to do if he played in today's game? What kind of damage could Bo do on a weekly basis? Funny you should ask, because Bo himself has been thinking about that very thing. And while you were doing the Alfredo, Bo did the math.
And I'm like, if I played during this era, man, I'd be averaging 350, 400 yards. Because nobody wraps up anymore. They run into each other with the pads.
Notice Bo's the only one not laughing when he made that statement. Bo just said he would be averaging 350 to 400 yards per game in the NFL.
I'd be averaging 350, 400 yards a game.
In the NFL. I mean, I could see that in Tecmo Bowl. The only thing more impressive than real-life Bo Jackson was Tecmo Bowl Bo Jackson. Tecmo Bowl Bo was going for 350 to 400 per game every single time out. Hell, he was doing that in the first half. But in real life, in the NFL, 350 to 400 yards per game? In today's game? Listen, there are two dudes that I do not mess with, ever. Mike Tyson and Bo Jackson. I'm still afraid of Mike, especially since Mike admitted to me on my own TV show that he wanted to kill me and meant it. And I don't mess with Bo because I've got such profound respect for Bo. Like I said, best athlete I've seen in my entire lifetime. I don't mess with either one of those guys. And I'm never going to be the guy to say that Bo Jackson can't do something or couldn't do something because he did things that were freaking impossible, things that the best of the best couldn't even imagine, let alone actually execute. The worst place on the planet is standing between Bo Jackson and his goal because he will bleep you up. Except Bo averaged less than 75 rushing yards per game when he played. And yet he's telling us now that he would quadruple that in today's game. You know, I may have to pump the brakes on that one. Because 350 yards in three games would be great. 350 yards in two games would be damn impressive. 350 yards in a single game would be a record. And it would smash the best rushing game record in NFL history. But Bo is out up here saying he would average it. Like week in and week out, he'd be throwing down 350, 375, 400 yards. I mean, if Bo thinks that, Bo doesn't know. Bo doesn't know. But then again, maybe he does. Because my man's got a backup. He's got legitimate backup. He's got credible backup in the form of a jungle legend and another one of my favorite NFLers ever. Hall of Famer Kevin Green jumped into the fray. He saw a tweet from PFT about Bo's claim, and Kevin Green said, quote, "Bo's correct. He'd munch folks. If you don't have a physical mentality coupled with great tackling technique and fundamentals, he'd scarf your tail. Those attributes seem to be missing in today's play, especially on the back end. LBs are suspect as well." End of tweet. Such a good tweet. This has always been a big Kevin Green house, but I have even more respect for him after he dropped that "he'd munch folks" blast and then chased it with a "if you don't have a physical mentality coupled with great tackling technique and fundamentals, he'd scarf your tail." That's one tweet which includes "he'd munch folks" and one where he'd scarf folks. I'll tell you what, when I see that, it's got me rethinking this whole thing. Like maybe if Bo Jackson says it, maybe you agree with it. But if Bo Jackson says it and Kevin Green backs him up, then it must be. You know what? Maybe Bo could average 350 a game on the ground. He said it. Kevin Green agreed with it. So I believe it. Forget that nobody's ever done it even once. If Bo played today, he could do it every single week. Hey, you don't believe me? Go ask the boss. Go try and stand in front of Bo when he's running downhill. You'll get your ass munched and scarfed. Yeah, you do the Alfredo. I've done the math, and the math translates to roughly a 6,000-yard season. Bo would have a 6,000-yard season if he were playing today. And not only would he do it, he would do it every single year. And not only would he do it every single year, he'd do it for 10 years running. I've done that math too. Then he finishes with a career where he rushes for over 60,000 yards. Bo's right, and so is Kevin Green. Shout out to both you legends. I miss you both here in the jungle. Kevin Green hasn't come on in a few years, but he used to. Man, I wish I could tell you some of the things that he would tell me off air. Kevin Green is so awesome. And this is not the first time he's hyped Bo. Kevin came on this show back in 2016 and was talking about how back then, even he was saying it, Bo was the best of the best.
Oh, good Lord. It was a freight train, an absolute freight train. I'll never forget hitting that man as he was coming through the C gap with all I had. And he turned me around and just kept running. And then before I knew it, my position coach was all up in my grill, Romy, going, "You got to hit him, Green. You got to hit him." And I'm taking an ass chewing, and I'm thinking, I hit that man as hard as I possibly could, and for nothing. He went right through me like I was nothing. Bo is the real deal now. And I played against some of the best ones, Bo. I'm telling you, Marcus Allen and Herschel Walker, and Emmitt Smith, and Barry Sanders, and the great Walter Payton. But man, Bo was Bo. He was a special dude among special dudes.
Was Bo the best back you ever went up against, though?
No question, Rome. No question. Just the combination of athletic ability and skill, speed and power.
Hey, Ritt, when you hear that, don't you feel like, man, that guy would be so great to be on the podcast? Kevin Green, that is so strong. That's why I love Kevin Green. He said that. The coach is up in his grill saying, you got to hit that man. He's like, I got to hit that man. I hit that man with everything I had, and he ran right through me. That's Kevin Green, Hall of Famer, talking about Bo. So when he describes Bo the way he just did, that makes me think, you know what? Bo's not talking out his backside. Maybe Bo could go for 350 a week in today's NFL. Again, never mind that nobody's ever done it once. Bo was going to do it every single week. Maybe. Maybe. Especially when you hear that. I also got into it with Kevin Green. All right, so if that's the best running back you ever went up against, how about the best lineman? Give me a lineman, Kevin, that you used to have fierce, fierce fights with.
I had great competition specifically with Eric Williams. I mean, 6'6", bro, and 330 pounds, great feet. And a mean, freaking militant brother, man. I mean, we battled. We fought. And really the only way you beat that is you fight fire with fire. So when I beat him, I knew I beat one of the best, and I hammered Aikman. Only because I thought he was the best offensive tackle I'd seen on pretty much on game day. He was just great feet, and he had a great disposition for an offensive lineman, which is nasty and mean and you know, just pissy and angry, and he wants to pull your heart out through your throat.
He wants to pull your heart out through your throat. That's Kevin Green. I would say that about Kevin Green. A couple of jungle legends. Bo Jackson, greatest athlete I've ever seen. And at first I had to say, come on now, Bo, 350 per week, 400, easy, Bo. And then Kevin Green jumps in with, no, no, he could do it. He could do it. My guest is Doc Emmerich. Doc, it is so good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, I'm fine. How about yourself?
I'm super, Doc. I'm super, and it's great to hear your voice. Let me first ask you, after 50 years of broadcasting, you did announce your retirement last week. So how have the first few days of retirement been for you, Doc?
Let me suggest this, Jim. When you retire, don't launch a book the next day. Because it gets very busy very fast, and it was all the book launch date was determined 6 months ago, and the idea of me retiring was not determined until, probably early in the third round of this year's playoffs, which would have been sometime after Labor Day. But they all coincided at right around the same time because we had so much going on in hockey with the playoffs, and then the draft came right after that, and then free agency after that. And I didn't want to be a story that was occurring at the same time that the athletes were supposed to take center stage and needed to. So there really wasn't much time to shoehorn my retirement announcement in, except the Monday of a week ago. And so there it was. And then the book launch, which was long ago determined, became Tuesday. But I do get to talk to you. Where's the Dodgers parade going to be? Do you have any idea?
No, not at this point, Doc. Not at this point.
No, parades are hard to do now, aren't they? I know the Tampa Bay Lightning had one in the river that ran through downtown, so maybe that was what the Rays were going to do if, but it's different the way that we must celebrate, at least for a while longer.
No doubt about that. Everything is so different right now. Doc Emmerich is joining us. He's got a brand new book out. So, Doc, what made you decide that it was time for something new?
I would sit with people that were older than I was and they had retired, and they would maybe not make eye contact, Jim, but they would sort of look off in the distance and say, so how much longer are you going to do this? And my immediate thought was, although I didn't say it, does it sound like maybe I need to? But they would say, you'll know when it's time. And somewhere during the second and third round, I realized it had been 50 years since I covered my first NHL game and 40 years of doing NHL games on television, and those were round numbers. Plus, it was about that time that NBC told me that I would be okay to stay in my home and continue to do play-by-play of the third and fourth rounds of the playoffs. And that was not a tribute to me. It was a tribute to them and their loyalty to me and their protection of me all along to make sure that I stayed safe, because I've got a couple of boxes to check. One is my birth certificate, and another is that I have had cancer in my background, and you might be rolling the dice a little more if you wound up traveling, even though the bubble was very secure in both Toronto and Edmonton. But it just seemed like that was the time that I should be very fortunate in thinking that my health was good currently, knock on wood, and my wife's was too. And that with all of these great seasons and opportunities that I had, it was time to move on to another chapter and still enjoy the fact that they're going to give me a team jersey and let me do some video essays.
You bet. Doc Emmerich is joining us. He is the author of a brand new book, Off Mic, How a Kid from Basketball Crazy Indiana Became America's NHL Voice. Doc, Al Michaels said this of you, and I quote, "You have made the game so much more relevant, interesting, relatable, exciting. I think just in listening to you, people who love hockey and are in that cult, we love you. You've also brought a lot of people into the game who might not otherwise have paid attention to hockey," end of quote. Doc, you and I have spoken in the past about being the voice of hockey in America. Now that you have retired and you can look back and reflect, what does that title mean to you?
Well, it's applied to me by other people, and when it's applied to you by Al Michaels, who has had the most famous call in the history of hockey in the United States, that is a tremendous compliment. It was Al Michaels who also said of me once, "I could make a cockroach race look interesting or bring it to life for you." And I've often thought about what a cockroach race would look like.
Right.
And I don't know whether you would put different colored sweaters on them like you would put different colored silks on horses for a race or what, but what a creative way to think. And of course, that's what Al's done all his life. But I don't know what that mantle is like because other people have attributed it to me. I just know that I've felt very blessed to get in free to see over 3,700 games and to have gotten a chance to see some very great athletes perform. And that, I guess, is the thing that I'm happiest about and looking back over all these years, plus the people I've gotten to work with and occasionally to get on your show and chat about it all. When you consider that Bobby Hull and Bobby Orr and Gordie Howe were playing at the beginning of the time that I started watching hockey, and then Sidney Crosby and Alex Ovechkin and Connor McDavid and people like that were playing at the end, gosh, I've had a chance to see an awful lot. I'm really lucky.
Doc Emmerich is joining us. His book is now out. You know, Doc, when you mentioned some of the legends of the game, let me ask you about this, because there are so many great stories and anecdotes in the book. But 3 years ago at the All-Star Game here in Los Angeles, you hosted a roundtable with Wayne Gretzky, Bobby Orr, Mario Lemieux, Sidney Crosby, and Jonathan Toews. Knowing where you started and the passion you have for this game, what was it like for you to be amongst those five legends?
I didn't sleep the night before, Jim. I don't know if you've ever had that before. You had an interview that was maybe head and shoulders above the normal interview you might have. But I didn't have I prepared like crazy. But I didn't have a lot of rest the night before. And my first question was, do any of you have a question for anyone else? And if no one says anything, you've dropped a bomb in your very first question to try and get it started.
Right.
And Wayne Gretzky came to my aid because there was a picture of Bobby Orr in that famous 1970 Cup clinching goal scored at Boston Garden against St. Louis flying through the air. And Wayne's reaction to that question got us started with laughter. He turned to Orr and said, "Did it hurt when you fell?"
Huh. Great.
And that got us started. But I think the most awesome thing about that was to be in the presence of those five stars, a couple of them still active players, and to have the young guys just listen to what the guys from previous eras went through and could look back on in their careers. Because Mario and Wayne and Bobby Orr were all not only wonderful players but ambassadors for the sport. Just like Jonathan Toews and Sidney Crosby are currently. So it was just being in the presence of great people. And I had several questions that I didn't get time to ask at the end. But one of them was totally selfish, because since 1959, I've been a Pittsburgh Pirates fan, and the last 30 years, as you know, have not been good. And there has been some controversy about how much the owner is putting into the team, and in baseball it helps if you spend, and he does not. Mario tried to buy the team in 2010, and so my last question for him, which I didn't get time to ask, was, will you please consider making another offer for my favorite baseball team? But I never got to that.
Doc Emrick is joining us. Such a good story. The book is called Off Mic, How a Kid from Basketball Crazy Indiana Became America's NHL Voice. You know, Doc, you write in the book also, and I've talked about this on the show, but you write about this brilliantly, quote, the NHL's postseason is a quest. It's a mission. It's a life goal. It's more than a tournament. Even if you successfully complete the journey, you arrive at the finish line as battered, bruised, and weary as the opponents you conquered. It's all for a trophy you can't keep and a ring you rarely wear, I should say. Quote, end of quote. There's this great NHL commercial as well that cuts together one player after another who is speechless. They're emotional when they're with the cup. So how would you explain what the Stanley Cup means and why it is so unique and why it's so special?
Well, the ring that you don't usually wear, I remember talking to one of the Bruins in 2013, and that was 2 years after they had won Game 7 in Vancouver. And the rings are wonderful. They are loaded with diamonds. They are gaudy beyond belief. And I asked him how many times he'd worn his ring, and he held up one index finger. That doesn't mean he doesn't appreciate it. It's just that they are so gaudy that you just don't wear them every day. You don't wear them but once every so often. But the name your parents gives you when you are born is what goes on the trophy, and it has ever since the NHL took it over in 1917, and it did even before that. And that's why they sacrifice so much. They've been paid really well during the regular season. The money doesn't mean much for winning the Stanley Cup because it's not substantial at all. Everybody gets the same amount, and it's not substantial at all. But do they ever sacrifice for it? John Madden, who played for the New Jersey Devils in 2003, they won the championship, and I saw him the next fall at a golf outing, and I said, how long was it after you guys finished up that you were pain-free? He said, I remember one day around the middle of July, and they won it in early June. He said, I remember getting out of bed in early July, and that was the first time I didn't hurt somewhere. But he had a smile on his face when he said it. But that's how long it takes for all that battering to wear off. Now, if you win it in Game 7 like John did over the Ducks, that means that there's some Ducks that lost Game 7 that have the same experience of going through that pain. But the bottom line is they are professionals, and professional means you're paid, but it's not great. 1979, quick story. John Davidson's playing for the New York Rangers. They go into the Stanley Cup final against Montreal. They win the first game. And then Montreal wins the next four. Great year for the Rangers. Didn't win the Stanley Cup. Great year for them. They are celebrated throughout New York. So now he's back home. Summer has begun. A couple of weeks have passed. And he steps to the front door, and there's the mail. So he's going through the mail just to see what's there. And there's a letter from the National Hockey League. He said, I wonder what they want. And he opens the letter, and inside is his playoff check. And he said, I forgot we got paid.
Wow. Isn't that something? Doc Emrick joining us.
That's why they really compete so hard. They forget about all that stuff. It's about getting your name on the trophy.
You know, Doc, when you tell that story, it makes me think that normally when somebody says it's not about the money, it's about one thing, the money. Except when you or they say it's not about the money, in that regard, it really is not about the money because he didn't even know that check was coming. You know, the interesting thing, Doc, also about the book, you and your wife, Joyce, have announced that 100% of the book sales will go to hands-on care of animals. Now, you have dogs, but you also have horses. For those who do not know, how did you first get involved with horses?
It was one of those things that neither I nor her twin brother knew, that from the time she was a little girl, she would like to have had a horse. And it was during that long lockout of 04-05 that she had mentioned it again. And 04-05 is 15 years ago. And I won't give away her age, but it was not the normal time that women start riding horses. But so anyway, we decided, okay, let's try one. And then there was a rescue of a horse that was left starving in a field. And you don't nurse a horse back to health by just giving it as much food as it wants all of a sudden. You gradually work it back to health. And it was for sale for the vet bills, $240. That horse is still with us today, and as best we can tell, it's around 31, 32 years old.
Wow.
A lot of it is just we have a soft heart for these creatures, but that money does not necessarily go to their upkeep. NBC has taken such good care of us over 15 years that we're able to sustain the horses and our dogs and ourselves. But there are occasionally situations where anonymously we can help out somebody that needs to have a surgery on a treasured pet that might need some financial help in accomplishing it, because some surgeries are not cheap. And even though local vets around where we live, and that'll be the case wherever any of your listeners are listening, there are probably situations like that if they want to lend a hand locally, where it might be a sort of a backdoor, hey, how much do you need to get this accomplished, and write a check that they can help save this animal. And there's a place here, one last thing, Jim, if you have time, there's a place here near us called DAWG, D-A-W-G. It's the Detroit Animal Welfare Group, and they wind up rescuing all kinds of creatures. I saw them bring in a possum and a crow and a duck just last week. Now, these are God's creatures, and they needed help. And there are some veterinarians that will treat animals like that. And these good souls go out and they see that they're in need of help. And so they will bring them in and they will eventually be released. I have a video of a turtle with a cracked shell that was eventually healed up. And the video is of the turtle being released back into a pond. Obviously, Jim, you know this means something because I'm giving you more detail than you probably really need this afternoon, but I really do appreciate your mentioning that because it means a lot to us, and it brings a smile to our face when you see a successful thing like that. You can't solve all the problems, but maybe a handful.
I love that, actually, Doc. I'm a big animal person, so I love that, and I think that cause is amazing. The book is called Off Mic, How a Kid from Basketball Crazy Indiana Became America's NHL Voice. The book is out right now. The proceeds go to that great cause. He is the voice of the NHL and NBC for 15 years, an 8-time Sports Emmy Award winner, and I would encourage you to get that book because it is out. Doc, I so appreciate the conversation and the relationship. I know this will not be the last time we have you on this show and we have this conversation, but congratulations on the book, and so good to have you back, Doc.
Great to talk to you, Jim, and I'm glad that it's not the last time. Wonderful. Thank you.
Are you craving some protein after a good workout? This time, do not make a shake or eat a bar. Instead, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty. It's tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire, and it goes with you wherever you go, to the game, to the gym, to the beach. So look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. And if you don't see it, clones, make sure you ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper. What's your beef? Edgerrin James, a brand new Hall of Famer, a 4-time Pro Bowler, currently awaiting a pandemic-delayed induction into Canton. I ran down Edge. Not only did I run him down, but I ran him down right in the middle of an ATV session. Ritt had said to me, Edge texted me and said he's good to go. He's going to be in the middle of an ATV session. He's just going to step off for a minute. And I said, man, I can't wait to talk to Edge. Are you sure? Is that how that's going to go? I mean, imagine being in the middle of an ATV session. That's exactly how that went, and it's awesome. My man was gracious enough to hop off the four-wheeler for 30 rock-solid minutes, chopping it up about one of the best and really one of the most unique careers in NFL history. A unique career that started with extremely humble beginnings. And we talked about the moment he went from having no money whatsoever to having a lot of money after he got drafted. It's always a fascinating notion to me. When you take somebody in any walk of life that has no money, and then you give them money, they have no value of that money because they've never had it. You know, $100,000 might seem like $100 million when in reality it's not. 100 grand to somebody who's never had any money, they probably don't know that 100 grand really is 50 grand. And 50 grand is not 50 mil. Anyway, Edge puts in all this time. He never has anything at all. And then he gets a lot of money after he gets drafted, but then he holds out before he signs that first deal with the Colts. And he talked about what that was like.
You get invited to the combine. That's you getting a step closer. And then all of a sudden, draft days come. You get a step closer, and then you get drafted, right? But I still don't have the money. And so if something happens to me, I don't know what would happen. If something happens to me while I'm a drafted player and I haven't gotten the money, we're still where we were at all the other times, you know? Then I end up holding out. You know, everybody else signed. You know, that was one of the hardest things to do, but you had to do what was right. You know, man, damn, do I sign this deal now just so I can secure the bag, or do I hold your position? And so it's like you're going through all this, and then all of a sudden, go to camp, you get that check. And now it's real. You know, until then, it was like, I'm not going to the club. I'm not going nowhere, because if something happens, I'm going to f*** up the whole situation, you know, just by being stupid, you know? So I wouldn't even go nowhere during my holdout. All I did was work out. I would call, talk to Peyton a lot. I talked to everybody on the offense, because I was like, man, I'm right there, but I don't want to get right there and then don't finish the job. Once I signed that deal, it's like, this is real now. You know, like, we really got some money, you know? And that's where that sign of relief comes from. You know, you're like, damn, we really got some money now. And now it's up to me to make sure we always have some money.
So good. 30 minutes of that from the Edge. That is so, so good. I love what he said about, like, the question I put to him was, you say that for the first time you could take a breath. You and your mom could take a breath when you got to the NFL. What do you mean by that? Because it was always so hard. They had nothing. He said, we didn't want for anything, but we never had anything. And it was hard. And it was challenging. He said, it was so challenging because then I get drafted, but I'm not signed. And I want to make sure, like, if something happens to me, I got that close, and then we still have nothing. And I was not able to help us. And then I hold out, and it was hard because other people were getting paid. I mean, that clip is packed with so much insight. Like, he was so close to the payday, but he still wanted to make sure he didn't screw it up. So I'm not going to the clubs. I'm not doing anything except working out and calling Peyton. I mean, so close to securing the bag, quote. But then he held out because he had to do the right thing. So what do? When you get that close and then you get that money, he said, my other responsibility was making sure that I kept the money so I could take care of those around me. How do you do that? He said, that's where discipline comes in.
Everybody's goal is to get to the NFL. Your goal has to be bigger than that. Your goal has to become a Hall of Famer, to become a Pro Bowler, become one of the top players. And that was always my goal, to become one of the guys that's going to end up one of those gold jackets. So it's like getting to the NFL, it does a lot for you. But I don't want to just be there. You know, I wanted to really, like, put my stamp on the game. That's what it's really about. The NFL comes down to discipline. It's because you have more temptations than ever. You know, now you have the freedom. You have the money. You feel like you've attained the thing that you've always set out to do. But you have to aim higher than that. So you hold yourself accountable and you make sure that I'm going to do what I have to do to not put myself in those situations. And, you know, if you look at the history of the game, it's the same story, no matter how many times you put it in front of everybody. But it takes the player to take the initiative and say, hey, man, I'm not going back to where I come from. And if that's the driving force, that's where that discipline comes in at.
No pun intended, but that's gold. That is gold. He told me that discipline was his cheat code. His cheat code in high school, his cheat code in college, his cheat code in the NFL, disciplined. And then when he trained in private throughout his career, he was doing it because he always was in competition with himself to get better and to be better than the guy in front of him. He has this great piece in the Players Tribune where he talks about learning early on in his life that football is actually a very easy game. All I have to do is outwork everybody. And if I outwork the man in front of me, I'm going to get over. I'm going to win. And that was his edge. That was his cheat code. He was looking for a way to get separation, and he found it in his discipline, his grind. And just making it was not good enough for him. The guy had gold jacket dreams from day one. He said it. He wanted to leave his mark on the game, and he did. And it was his discipline throughout his entire career that made that happen. It got him paid. It made him a legend. And that's why he's on his way to Canton right now as a headliner in the class of 2020, because of that discipline. And although he and Peyton Manning could not have had any different, more different backgrounds, he insisted the two of them were kindred spirits. They were connected in the way they prepared and how they worked, how they attacked all their challenges. Edge made the point that even though Manning had all these inherent advantages that Edge himself did not have when he was growing up, he actually respected Manning for the way he attacked his craft, because there weren't distractions. He was totally in. He was all locked in on the craft itself. Edge says he's looking to set his own kids up the same way the Manning family set up their kids.
That guy was always about his craft, and he always taking care of his business was always taking care of it. It's a difference when you come from an African-American household and you don't have somebody to show you the way. And then you see somebody that comes from a good family, and they have a father that's been there, and they have a nice family structure. And you say, damn, that's pretty tight, because he's able to focus on football and doing what he has to do, and any endorsement or anything that has to do with his personal or his business or whatever, with his craft. You know, with us, we have to deal with different things. You know, we have to deal with, well, we're the first person in our family that has some money. We have to deal with all these motherfuckers that ain't have no money, that have all these needs and wants. So you see somebody that can just focus on their business and focus on what they have to focus on, man, it's pretty impressive, man. And that's one thing you like. I wish I could be like that with my children. You know, I can say, man, you know what? You don't have to worry about dealing with these hanger owners. You don't have to worry about dealing with these bad people. I'm going to make sure you're able to just focus on your business. That's one thing I've always seen, a person that was committed to their craft, and he was able to just focus on his business and do what he had to do. And his record shows, you know, and that's one thing I always respect about that family and the way they went about it. So when you're talking about their business, they're strictly about their business. They don't have to deal with bull we got to deal with, you know.
So good. Edge is also on record as saying that Peyton Manning is the undisputed heavyweight champion of being about his business. You see what I mean about that conversation? And those bleeps, I mean, that's not for effect. That's not gratuitous. That's him being emphatic. He's making his point. We can't have that kind of conversation on this show. That long-form conversation, that kind of raw conversation, that real conversation. This is why I have that podcast. And Edge, before I leave that topic, he's not only fiercely proud of what he did in the NFL, and believe me, he's all about the U, but he is a fiercely proud parent who believes that his legacy is very much grounded in fatherhood. He's cultivating all sorts of opportunities for his kids to take advantage of, and he's creating circumstances that he himself did not have growing up. He told me this is generational to him. He's the patriarch. He takes a ton of pride in that and responsibility in that. Now, there were some light moments, too. The highlight may have been when he told the story about the 2009 Super Bowl in Tampa. Edge was with the Cardinals at that point, taking on Pittsburgh. Sort of a homecoming for him to come back to Florida for the biggest game of his life. Like, he worked his entire life for that moment, so he wanted to go all out, and he did. He went to a Lamborghini dealership and stroked a check for a whip that he never even test drove, never even sat in.
I always said, if I make it to the Super Bowl, I'm going to do something. You know, I'm going to do something. So I went to a dealership, and I was like old school cars, and you know, I always rode like a Benz or something. And I was like, man, let me get something that's popping. And so I went to the dealership and went to Lamborghini of Miami. And you know, I don't really know much about the sports cars. I don't really know much about none of that right there because it wasn't my thing. But I said, hey, give me the baddest you got, you know. And he had this white with red interior Lamborghini Murcielago. I'm playing for the Cardinals. We red, we white, everything just matched up. And he said, what's the price? And when he said what the price is, I said, all right, cool, pay for it cash. And I said, man, look, can you drop it off at the hotel? We'll be back in 2 weeks. And they got the car in front of the hotel. Me and a couple of my boys, you know, we're like, we're going to ride around Tampa. And everybody started coming out and started coming around. And I'm like, I'm just jumping in the car. I'm thinking that you put the key in, you turn it, pull the gear shift. None of that is there. It's like, what the f*** did I just pay for? You know what I'm saying? Because it's like, it's empty in there. You know, it's like, it's not much in a car. It's just a car with buttons, nothing. Nothing traditional. So I'm looking for the gear shift. I'm looking for it. And so I'm like, damn, what's up? And after sitting there going through this thing over and over, I'm like, f*** this, man. Who knows how to start this man? Because I don't know. I have no idea, no clue. And man, let's just stop playing around with it. Because I really want to drive the car, but I need somebody to start this car.
One of my favorite athlete stories. That is so great. He's like, man, give me the hottest bleep you got. It's white. It's red. It's the Cardinal colors. I got my family there. I got my friends there. I got my teammates there. They dropped that thing in front of the hotel. It's the week of Super Bowl. Man, let's get in this thing. He says, I get into it, and there's nothing traditional about it. There's no ignition. There's nowhere to put the key. It's all buttons. It's all buttons. Such an amazing story. He pays cash for a Lambo, didn't test drive it, didn't even sit in it, had it delivered the week of Super Bowl, and does not know how to start it. And never forget that draft, 99. And one more thing I got into, I talked about one of my favorite athletes. If you know me and you know this show, you know I'm a huge Bob Sanders guy. I asked him about Bob Sanders, and we got into that too. If you remember that draft, Colts fan, I know you do, and I know what your response was when they selected him. Colts fan thought that they were going to get Ricky Williams, who was available, after the Eagles took Donovan. Then Indy took Edge. And a lot of you were concerned about that, weren't you, Colts fans? And I love Ricky, but they made the right call. They drafted a future Hall of Famer. Make sure you listen to the entire episode because he reveals how he finally got that rig started. He talks about his time at the U. He talks about why football is an easy game. And he talked about his first impression of Jim Irsay. And he talked about what would happen when he did bump into opposing players in the club. Such a good listen. If you like that, there's 30 minutes of nothing but that. You can find it on Spotify, JimRome.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, my Twitter page. It's got it pinned at the very top. I highly, highly recommend it. And again, for that reason, when you hear those beeps and you hear how raw the conversation is, I can't do that here. I can't do that in daytime hours on terrestrial radio. But I can do that on the podcast. So make sure you look for The Edge.
Good night now!